Good evening, everyone. I'm Robert Johansson. I'm Deputy Chancellor at the University of Melbourne, and I'm delighted to welcome so many of you here tonight for this, the fourth NAM Oration. We've named the NAM Oration in honour of the country on which we now sit. NAM is the Walwarong name for the country surrounding Port Phillip Bay. The NAM Oration is companion to the Dungala Kayalya Oration, which we hold each year in Shepparton. The two orations differ in focus. The Shepparton Oration is focused on regional Indigenous issues, whereas the NAM Oration, this one, profiles leading Indigenous thinkers from across the globe in order to enrich our vision for the future of Indigenous Australia. Tonight, our program commences with a formal welcome to country to be given by Auntie Joy Murphy Wandon. Auntie Joy, she's known to many of us around the university. She's a valued patron of the university's Indigenous programs, and she's a regular visitor to the campus. She's an Aboriginal elder of the Wurundjeri people, and she's been involved with Aboriginal issues now for over 30 years. She's chairperson of the Australian Indigenous Consultative Assembly and has held executive positions across many sectors of government. She's an honorary professor at Swinburne University, a trustee of the National Gallery of Victoria, a member of the Victorian Police Ethical Standards Consultative Committee and the Equal Opportunity Commission. She's an Australia Day ambassador, and she also has a business. And I invite her to give the welcome to country, Auntie Joy.
Thanks very much, Robert. It's a great pleasure to be here again for the NAM Oration 2012. I'd like to begin by very much paying my respects to my father and my ancestors, and indeed to all elders and ancestors across this great continent and our neighbouring islands. I'd also like to acknowledge each and every one of the brothers and sisters that are with us here this evening, and some of you that I haven't seen for a long time. And it's a great gathering of our community, and one of those times, even no matter when it is, that we need to do more often. But I would also like to acknowledge the University of Melbourne and just thank them for their continued support and the way in which they engage in spirit of our culture. And I think that's the absolute partnership of where so many of organisations, no matter where they are, institutions, no matter where they are, that they embrace and engage in Aboriginal culture. I was just thinking a moment ago how undressed I was, and I kind of didn't have a gown or much, and I've just got this floppy cardigan on, and I really felt quite out of place. So I just want to make a mention of the procession to each and every one of you as you enter. It really does make us feel very proud, and all in all, the stature and the way in which it's held, your presence in an auditorium is, I guess, just awesome. But I do have a loan of a gown, so I feel a little bit more appropriate. I think the other thing for me to share with you tonight is simply that at this very moment, being the senior elder of the Wurundjeri people, it's a great honour for me, and it's a privilege. And I really don't take this position lightly. I cannot be the head man or the head woman. I can only be the senior woman. And rightly so, as we have the Murrup Barrack, in terms of celebrating the success of our men that have walked that long journey before our time, the success, I guess, of many of our men that followed, and they include my two brothers who have just left me in the last few years. The headman of the Wurundjeri is called the Narangita, and it's important, I think, in that regard to ensure that that spirit of the Narangita is not lost. The way in which the Narangita has led people for many, many years, and the way in which that leadership title is given. It isn't a given. It's a matter of how that is given to you. And I know that when my grandfather had the great honour of being named as the sister of Barak, the sisters of the son, Barak's mother, the sister, gave the notice that Robert Wandoon shall be the next Narangita only if the community agrees with him. If he's found to be a bad man, then they may choose someone else, mother's sister, mother's brother. So then that was the time of change when Barak had left us, when the wattles bloom again in August. And so for me, as I said earlier, it is a moment of great pride, and I do really seriously acknowledge that as a senior woman, I take full responsibility and am accountable for all of my culture. Could I also say that there's so much to embrace these days, and we tend to have so many things to do, each and every one of us in our community. And it is at this time that I'd like to acknowledge Professor Megan Davis and say to you that as a woman, I sometimes feel the load is just way too much. And it's great to have that momentum of self-determination, and we keep that, but it also has to be self-managed. And I'm looking forward very much to hear what you say, and then hopefully I have some words of wisdom that can help me along my journey. I don't have gum leaves with me tonight, and I'm not apologising. What I'm going to do is send you out to country, and no matter what happens out there in nature, whether it's rain, hail, thunder, lightning, we had the whole lot this morning at Healesville, so I guess we'll get it sometime again today or very soon, I'm sure. But I would invite you to stop at a manigum. A manigum is a tree that has quite a long trunk, so it may not be possible for you to reach out and just grab a leaf. You'd probably have to make a couple of toe holes along the way and then be able to manage that skill to get up to climb the trunk as our community did in traditional times. But nevertheless, can I just suggest to you that because of all the eucalypt that were used in ceremony in traditional times, it's okay to just stop at a beautiful eucalypt tree. Take a leaf. And in taking that leaf, it means that you are welcome to everything from the tops of the trees to the roots of the earth. It also means that you join with me to pay your respects and honour the spirits of our leaders, our Narangita, like Barak, and those that were before him and those that have continued to follow. It's a great pleasure to be with you again for the Nam oration. My language is the Woi Wurrung, Women Jakar Wurundjeri Balak, Yemen Kundibik, and you are most welcome to the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. Thank you.
Thanks very much for your most generous welcome. And I'd like to again acknowledge the contribution, the great contribution you make around the university and around Melbourne, and pay my respects again to the Wurundjeri people and all the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people present here tonight. A lot of people have come tonight from outside the university, from government, corporate, community organisations. In particular, we have visitors from Rio Tinto Australia, the Murray Barrick Foundation corporate partner. We have some people I'd like to name in particular. Senator Rachel Seward is here from Western Australia. She's the Greens spokesperson on Indigenous Affairs. The Honourable Bronwyn Pike is here, who was Minister of Education in the state government some little while ago. The Honourable Barry Jones is here. I'm not sure he actually qualifies as being from outside the university anymore. But he was, as you will remember, minister for lots of things in various governments, so welcome to you. And welcome to David Peaver, the Managing Director of Rio Tinto Australia. So it's now time to move to the purpose of this evening, which is the Naam Oration, and my great pleasure to introduce tonight's orator, Professor Megan Davis. Professor Davis comes to us from the University of New South Wales, where she's Professor of Law and Director of the Faculty of Law's Indigenous Law Centre. She's the first Indigenous Australian to be elected by the United Nations Economic and Social Council to serve on a UN body. Her appointment is as expert member of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. She's also a commissioner on the New South Wales Land and Environment Court. In 2012, she was elected the rapporteur of the UN Permanent Forum in Indigenous Issues expert group meeting in New York on violence against Indigenous women. Professor Davis is a fellow of the Australian Academy of Law and the Australian member of the International Law Association's Indigenous Rights Committee. In 2011, she was appointed by the federal government to the expert panel on the recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in the Constitution. She has extensive experience as an international lawyer, including the drafting of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples from 1999 to 2004. She's a former UN Fellow of the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva. She grew up in Queensland. Her country is Warra in southwest Queensland. During the Protection Era, her family was moved to Cherbourg, and her father eventually settled in the southeast, where Megan grew up in Hervey Bay and Eagleby. She attended the University of Queensland, where she studied law and arts. She holds a graduate diploma in legal practice, a Master of Laws, International Law, and a Doctor of Philosophy from the Australian National University. She's an admitted solicitor of the Supreme Court of the ACT. In 2010, she was the 2010 NAIDOC Scholar of the Year. And this university is particularly honoured that she is with us tonight to present the fourth Naam Oration. She's the first Australian orator in this series of orations that we present annually to profile Indigenous thinkers from across the globe. Her qualifications and experience both nationally and internationally qualify her very well to give this oration. So welcome, Megan, welcome to the lectern to give the oration you have titled Aboriginal Women, the Rights to Self-Determination. Megan Davis.
Well, now I wish I had have edited that biography. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, as a Cobble Cobble Aboriginal woman from southwest Queensland, I acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, and thank you, Aunty Joy, for that very moving and meaningful welcome to country, and also the privilege of being able to wear the possum skin. I would also like to thank Professor Ian Anderson for inviting me to deliver the 2012 Naam Oration, which I consider a great honour and a great privilege. Thank you, Ian. And in addition, I think I should make a special mention and thanks to Ellen Day from the University of Melbourne for organising my time here, for getting me here. And she's been very kind and patient in relation to my somewhat chaotic schedule. And finally, I would also like to acknowledge Professor Marcia Langdon. I was privileged to be able to sit on the expert panel on the recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in the Constitution with Marcia last year, and also Rachel Seward, who's in the audience tonight. And I was fortunate to spend a lot of time with Marcia talking about issues to do with Aboriginal women and certainly consider you now a dear friend. And Marcia's early scholarship on Aboriginal women and land rights and Aboriginal women and feminism was a significant influence on me in pursuing the field of research of Aboriginal women and political participation that I have pursued. And I've really enjoyed watching a new generation of Aboriginal lawyers and scholars at the University of New South Wales read and discover Marcia's early scholarship in my subject, Indigenous Women and the Law. So thank you, Marcia. So when Ian invited me to deliver the oration, I remembered that the last occasion he asked me to speak here at the University of Melbourne was almost 10 years ago to the day. As a very junior academic, we were both young back then, Ian. And so it was wonderful to be asked and to be able to be back here and return to the University of Melbourne to deliver this oration 10 years later with myself as a professor and now Ian as the Assistant Vice-Chancellor in Indigenous Higher Education Policy. And in preparing for tonight, I reflected on the last time that I did speak here, because I think it's somewhat tangentially anyway relevant to what I want to speak about tonight. And so 10 years ago, I've got the file out in terms of the paper I did give, which was actually on a floppy disk, which goes to show how things have changed. But 10 years ago, the topic du jour was the treaty process. So Ian had asked me to come and speak on the treaty process that was going on in Australia at the time. And I remember looking at the paper and thinking, oh, how the times have changed. Back then, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission still existed, and treaty and self-determination remained central to Indigenous rights advocacy and part of the national discussion and debate on Indigenous rights. But today, self-determination has been eviscerated from the lexicon of Australian politicians and policymakers, Australian journalists and political commentators, and somewhat inelegantly and certainly inaccurately dismissed as a failed experiment and antithetical to Aboriginal economic development. But as we discovered last year as members of the Prime Minister's expert panel, a treaty and the language of self-determination remains at the forefront of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities' concern when they reflect upon this issue of recognition. So despite the adjournment in the use of self-determination by the political elite, the right to self-determination and human rights or the rights agenda remains fundamental to the aspirations of Aboriginal communities. And given Australia's Aboriginal history, take the protection era, for example, where draconian controls were placed on Aboriginal people's right to speak language, right to marriage, freedom of movement, freedom of speech and association, draconian controls on their right to hold property, and their right to participate in political choices that govern one's lives, it would be ahistorical to pillory or admonish the allegiance of the Aboriginal political domain to human rights, to the corpus of international human rights law. So it is the case that in Aboriginal communities, Aboriginal culture has been porous to international human rights norms. Indigenous communities have been enthusiastic about and open to rights as informing and framing their relationship with the state. However, this devotion to the rights agenda has been mostly uncritical and sometimes dogmatic, and its implementation or translation skewed. I say this because the fundamental norm that underpins the corpus of Indigenous rights, so eagerly embraced by Aboriginal communities, the right to self-determination, has arguably promoted an impoverished form of self-determination for Aboriginal women in Australia. And in the course of my work as a member of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, I can say with clarity that this appears to be the case for most Aboriginal women in the world. So tonight, in the spirit of the NAM oration, which is aimed at enriching our ideas about possible futures for Indigenous Australia in a way that remains grounded and respectful, but open to new ways of thinking, I want to explore this further. I want to expound on why I believe it is that self-determination, as configured in international law, translated by the state, and adopted by Aboriginal communities, has been skewed in a way that actually impedes the capacity of Aboriginal women and girls to freely determine their political status and their economic, social, and cultural destiny. This is an important inquiry because Aboriginal women in Australia are the most vulnerable and marginalised group of any in Australian society. Many Aboriginal women are routinely subjected to violence and high levels of stress, and are regularly positioned by statistical data in the lowest categories of economic and social status. Yet, despite the extensive chronicling of these facts over the years, they have not been seriously taken into account in the context of Indigenous people's rights and the framework of self-determination. So tonight I want to achieve two things. First, I want to sketch for you a picture of self-determination and Aboriginal women in Australia, illustrating the invidious vagueness of the concept that, in its discursive narrative, is too often abstracted from and incongruous with the daily lives of Aboriginal women. The Australian experience of self-determination has been state-centric, overly reliant on state acts, and I would argue, calibrated according to the male experience. Consequently, the strong conditioning force of culture, the privileging of race or culture, and the concomitant marginalisation of gender has ultimately been to the detriment of Aboriginal women's well-being and bodily integrity. Then, in the second part of the lecture, again in the spirit of the NAM oration, I want to take up the important challenge that is laid down by this event, by this important event in terms of new ways of thinking. So I'm going to suggest an alternative framework for a reimagining self-determination. Here, I will draw upon Martha Nussbaum's capabilities approach as a complementary framework to Indigenous rights. I will argue that the capabilities approach can do what human rights discourse can't do alone, and that is enliven rights advocacy in a way that gives specificity and shape and texture to the vocabulary of self-determination. And adopting the capabilities approach is only one of the many ways we can reimagine the right to self-determination. But in problematising the right to self-determination in relation to the marginalisation of women, I'm encouraging others to conceive of ways in which we can achieve self-determination that is inclusive and responsive to the unique experiences, needs and aspirations of all individuals within the collective. And in Australia, where Aboriginal groups and Aboriginal women are highly localised in terms of geography and culture, self-determination can only be elucidated in a context-specific way. Self-determination must become more specific and personalised in order to be capable of reflecting what self-determination actually means for people in their daily lives. And we cannot leave it to the state to do that for us. We, as Aboriginal people, must do that. So to begin with, I wanted to provide you with a truncated history of the right to self-determination internationally and domestically. The right to self-determination is the right of peoples to freely determine their political status and their economic, social, and cultural destiny. It underpins the normative framework of Indigenous peoples' rights in international law. It is a concept with a long pedigree in international law and politics, beginning with the Enlightenment, then becoming synonymous with decolonisation at the end of World War II, and then aligning with democratic governance at the end of the Cold War. Thomas Frank has labelled it the oldest aspect of the democratic entitlement. It is the right of a people in an established territory to determine its collective political destiny in a democratic fashion and is therefore at the core of the democratic entitlement. Self-determination has a relatively more recent history in the politics of Indigenous peoples who adopted it as they turned to the United Nations in the 60s and the 70s in the absence of domestic remedy for dispossession and racial discrimination. And when the General Assembly adopted the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in 2007, the right to self-determination, as recognised in the individualistic corpus of international law, was extended beyond individuals in democratic states to include Indigenous peoples collectively. The right to self-determination is taken seriously in most states of the world that have Indigenous communities, because self-determination in its true form is intended to enhance democracy and enhance political participation. And for this reason, it has animated voluminous academic commentary and scrutiny, particularly in the context of the multifarious aspects of political participation in liberal democracies, for example, designated parliamentary seats, Indigenous parliaments, Indigenous constitutional recognition. And many countries have done this well. So then if we look to Australia, we can trace the development of self-determination from the adoption of the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination in 1965, and then the Commonwealth Government, who introduced a self-determination policy in 1972. And this heralded a period of bipartisan support for over 30 years until the demise of ATSIC in around 2005, and saw the introduction of legislation giving effect to self-determination, such as the Northern Territory Aboriginal Land Rights Act, the Aboriginal Councils and Associations Act, and the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Commission, just to name a few. This form of self-determination, this legislative institutional form, reflects an Indigenous jurisdiction entirely informed by state acts. And like me, Australian historian and anthropologist Tim Rouse has questioned the deployment of land rights or the Indigenous jurisdiction as the only anchor for Aboriginal aspirations to self-determination. And why do we say that? The adoption of a policy of self-determination for Indigenous peoples by the Commonwealth Government meant that the developing norm of self-determination became state-centric, focused on the state, and less attention was paid to how the right to self-determination should be managed internally within Indigenous groups themselves, especially in regard to Aboriginal women, gender equality, and violence. The state-centric focus of the right and the patriarchal nature of Western public institutions inculcated Aboriginal political culture and institutions to the detriment of Aboriginal women's rights and status in Aboriginal communities. And there is a wealth of evidence to support this position. For example, the Northern Territory Aboriginal Land Rights Act. There is plenty of evidence to suggest that Aboriginal women were marginalised from the development of the land rights legislation and land councils, and that anthropologists, the very important profession that drove policy development on Aboriginal people in the early days, privileged the stories and the status of Aboriginal men over Aboriginal women, and this influenced policy. Another example might be the voluminous evidence we have of the way in which Aboriginal customary law has been used in courts to mitigate crimes of violence and sexual assault against Aboriginal women in sentencing. So, in that example, the privileging of culture over the fundamental human rights of Aboriginal women. Another example might be the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Commission. This was a state-centric institutional form of self-determination. And in its own evaluation report that it released in 1995 in relation to the effectiveness of ATSIC programs and policies for Aboriginal women, it found that women had little involvement in formal ATSIC decision-making processes, and few women were familiar with or had access to ATSIC's programs and services. The report's final conclusion was a clear indicator of ATSIC's failure to deliver self-determination to women. It read, "All in all, what lay at the heart of their concerns, women's concerns, was that decisions that affected them, their communities and families were invariably made with limited input from the women these decisions would most affect. The very essence of self-determination." And this report is a really powerful reminder from that particular era of how Aboriginal women were excluded from the bodies designed to achieve self-determination. It reveals the limitations of an institutional approach for self-determination if effective measures are not taken to ensure the political participation of women. Another example might be the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. It was established in 1987 following national outrage over the number of Aboriginal deaths in custody. It investigated 99 deaths that had occurred between the 1st of January 1980 and the 31st of May 1989 in prisons, police stations, and juvenile detention institutions. And of the 99 deaths investigated, 11 were women. So important statistics emerged at the time that the number of deaths of Indigenous women by alcohol-related homicide was more than the deaths in custody for the period of the Royal Commission. And despite these alarming statistics about the deaths of Aboriginal women at the time, due mainly to interpersonal violence between Aboriginal men and Aboriginal women, the problems concerning Indigenous women were overshadowed by the problems concerning Indigenous people, which in reality equated to problems facing Indigenous men. Audrey Bolger made the same point in her seminal 1991 report, Aboriginal Women and Violence. Bolger noted that during 1987 and 1988, three Aboriginal men died in custody in the Northern Territory. Yet, in the same period, of the 39 homicides recorded in the Northern Territory, 17 of them were Aboriginal women, most at the hands of Aboriginal men. When the number of Aboriginal people in custody was brought to the public attention, it caused such consternation that they set up a Royal Commission, and rightly so. Yet the fact that Aboriginal women particularly suffer far greater violence in their own communities and are much more likely to be killed and injured in and around their own homes, caused no such similar public outrage. And I suppose if I think of one more example, in more recent times, it seems to me that in relation to the Northern Territory Emergency Response or the Northern Territory Intervention, the Aboriginal political domain struggled with the public scrutiny of the dialectical tension between rights to land and the rights of women and children to be safe. Given the volume of literature and commentary that challenges the legitimacy and motives of the intervention's land reform measures, it is evident that the political domain can effectively and convincingly and passionately discharge a defence of Aboriginal land rights and associated procedural rights. What is of interest to my inquiry is that as a consequence of the poorly developed concept of the right to self-determination, the Aboriginal political domain equivocated on issues of women's rights and children's rights. The inchoate concept of the right to self-determination meant that the Aboriginal polity was ill-prepared philosophically and politically to deal with any rights arguments other than land rights or the Racial Discrimination Act. The debate about the intervention has brought to the surface the once unspoken tension between the collective self-determination and Aboriginal women's rights. And while the response of the Aboriginal polity to the intervention indicates that the undifferentiated, standardised mode of Aboriginal politics is strongly entrenched, the intervention probably too represents a critical juncture in Aboriginal self-determination as it applies to women, especially as we can see that more women feel the freedom and feel they have the space to speak up in a contrary manner to the dominant political domain. So these are just some examples of the research that I've done on the limitations of self-determination to date in Australia. But add to this, what I think is important is the strong conditioning force of culture. Women, including women like me, don't like to say these things because of the nature of intimidation and bullying that goes on when the light is shone on intracultural tensions. And this is probably why there is very little written in Australia about Aboriginal women and self-determination. And the limited literature that does exist about Aboriginal women and self-determination is essentialised. It's predicated on an assumption that Aboriginal women are solely aligned with Aboriginal men and the Aboriginal rights movement. So you will find in Aboriginal political statements on self-determination that, of course, there's no mention of women or differentiation between Aboriginal men and Aboriginal women's aspirations or goals. Indigenous people is taken as a universal and singular standpoint for the purposes of political strategy. So this assumption means that there is no need to interrogate self-determination in terms of what it means to women and what impact it actually has on their lives. Strategically, politically, it's more effective to engage with the state if Aboriginal men and Aboriginal women are united on all issues. I suppose, though, to dismiss the construction of Indigenous peoples as a collective only for political strategy fails to appreciate the subtle and insidious way, the direct and indirect way, that sex discrimination operates to marginalise and exclude women. So while the primacy of race loyalty and communal responsibility is justifiable and understandable, less scrutinised is the way in which women often sacrifice their own well-being and safety for the greater good, particularly because of the power of the harrowing narratives about the emasculation of Aboriginal men and their displacement as a result of colonisation. And that is certainly reinforced, for example, by the Royal Commission report, which found that it didn't look at Aboriginal women's issues because they'd concluded that Aboriginal women had fared better in colonisation than Aboriginal men. So just to sum up this part of the oration, the right to self-determination has never been prescriptive enough. It's typical of international human rights law. It lacks specificity because it's both an abstract human right, but it's also primarily employed as a political tool. In Australia, the focus has been on land rights, the creation of institutions to deliver self-determination. And the literature abounds with evidence to support the view that Indigenous rights are based on a narrative calibrated according to the dominant idea of what it means to be Indigenous and thus and that is invariably male. The narrative is the male prisoner, the male spiritual custodian of culture, the male victim of colonisation, the male perpetrator as victim. This, and the state-centric nature of the right, has meant that less time has been given to determining what the content of self-determination may mean to people living in their communities. Moreover, because self-determination is state-centric, attempts to define the content pay too much attention to that relationship with the state, and too little is given to Aboriginal people's relationships with each other. And we know this because over the past three decades, Aboriginal organisations, corporations, representative bodies, land councils, the groups that make up the collective self, have to a large extent ignored the marginalisation of women and certainly the violence experienced by women in communities. And I think it's appropriate here to quote from a true champion of Indigenous rights in the United Nations system, Professor Erica Irene Dyers, who was the former Special Rapporteur of the UN Working Group on Indigenous Populations. And she says, it's important that we must try to guard against a kind of false consciousness with respect to achieving the true spirit of Indigenous self-determination. The true test of self-determination is not whether Indigenous peoples have their own institutions or legislative authorities, laws, Indigenous police or Indigenous judges. The true test of self-determination is whether Indigenous peoples themselves actually feel that they have choices about their way of life. It's whether Indigenous peoples feel that they have choice about their way of life. And Dyers agrees that the emphasis on regulatory instruments, such as land laws and corporate laws, masks the way in which these instruments may in fact operate against the achievement of self-determination. So having identified what I see as some of the limitations of the right to self-determination in the context of Aboriginal women being able to achieve self-determination, I want to sketch an alternative vision of self-determination and to that extent, taking up the challenge of the Nam oration, thinking of an alternative vision of how we might be able to conceive self-determination. So I'm going to draw on the capabilities approach to human functioning is elaborated by the American philosopher Martha Nussbaum. And part of my attraction to this is that it's been very influential and very effective at the United Nations level and internationally. The capabilities approach is a normative framework based on the empirical work of economist Amartya Sen and also the philosopher Martha Nussbaum. And it's been so influential that it's been taken up by the UNDP in terms of their development of the publishing of their human development reports. So the capabilities approach shifts the measure of how we measure well-being. So to provide you with a brief version, because we could be all night if I laid it out in total for you. Sen was working in the development field, and he identified shortcomings in the way that quality of life was traditionally measured by economists. He noted that the quality of life of citizens within nations was ranked according to crude and inexact measurements of income and consumption. So, while wealthy developed nations can marshal and distribute significant resources to their citizens, there's actually no measurement of the equality of that distribution. Thus, it's not possible to extrapolate from such a homogeneous approach to quality of life how education, health, race, or gender inform the use of these resources. So SEN, in developing the capabilities approach, looked to a framework of measuring instead what people are actually able to do and to be. So this approach pays attention to a citizen's ability to achieve. And so in this way, the capabilities approach is an evaluative tool or framework in which the traditional indicator of welfare economics, utility, is replaced by the freedom to be and do. To explain further, utilitarian economics does not take account the cultural pressures that affect individuals' preferences and desires in life, because it assumes that people are rational agents seeking to maximise utility regardless of the pressures of norms or traditions. Thus, if we do not have information about how people actually choose to live their lives, then we can't improve people's lives. So an example of this utilitarian ethic in the context of Australia's Aboriginal affairs can be seen in, you know, the frequently expressed, you know, comment by people in the media and others that, oh, we throw so much money at this problem. We throw billions at this problem. And in 2008, and I think it was at Senate Estimates, Tom Calmer, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, asked, when the Commonwealth Government was to some extent boasting about its record levels of expenditure in the field, he asked, since when did the size of input become more important than the intended outcomes? And he questioned why the record expenditure was emphasised by the government when there was no measurement of the effects of this funding. And in fact, if you dig a bit deeper, a proportion of that record funding that the Commonwealth was talking about included Commonwealth monies expended on legal fees for farmers and pastoralists challenging Aboriginal native title claims in the court system. So this demonstrates what SEN has described as the informational poverty of the utilitarian calculus in the task of understanding how it is that people actually live their daily lives. An impersonal figure or amount does not tell us how the money is being spent and who is actually benefiting. So as an evaluative framework, this capabilities theory is based on the premise that in order to live a valuable human life, a person must have the freedom to make choices about how they live their life. So to enjoy that freedom, one must have the capabilities in order to do and be, to work, to be healthy, to read, to care, to love, to be well fed, or to have shelter. So I was attracted in particular to Martha Nussbaum's work because she's built on and refined Amartya Sen's approach to capabilities, focusing on the correlation between women, poverty, and sex inequality. So Nussbaum's work, mainly based in India, observed that women in many cultures are not treated as individuals with their own needs and aspirations. And in the case of women, Nussbaum found that poverty affects what women hope for, what they love, what they fear, and what they are able to do. Fundamental to Nussbaum's approach is her concern that women limit their expectations. Women adjust to the expectations their culture and their community have of them. This is known as adaptive preferences, which basically means that culture and cultural practices can limit or neglect women's autonomy. Therefore, utilitarianism, especially in measuring inequality, does not address the fact that women and the poor are generally satisfied with having less and expecting less. So just two examples. One might be that land rights, land is the fundamental aspect of our culture. And if we look to the Northern Territory Aboriginal Land Rights Act, you know, land rights are the normative benchmark for Aboriginal self-determination. And Aboriginal women aspire to land rights, even if they are not included in decision-making about the land, they're not included in decision-making about royalties, or if such land title never actually improves their life. It never actually improves their choices in life. Another example might be the strong cultural pressure not to report violence or discuss or complain about violence. This pressure influences the behaviour of Aboriginal women, as evidenced by the statistics of underreporting of violence against women. So, why the capabilities approach, and how does that fit with this Indigenous rights project, the self-determination project? In selecting an appropriate model to refashion or rethink about the way that we think about self-determination, I was motivated by the need to render self-determination more inclusive of Aboriginal people in a way that Aboriginal people are more likely to achieve self-determination than maintaining the current impersonal, standardised normative framework. Essentially, the capabilities approach is a species of the human rights approach because its goal is to ensure that people function in areas of central importance to a society. So the difference between Sen's approach and Nussbaum's approach, which is why I like her approach, is that she's devised a list. So she asks communities themselves to decide what areas of central importance to decide what areas in their lives are of central importance to that community, to give precision to the language of rights, to supplement the language of rights. It is intended to make human rights more accurate. So it transforms human rights from a narrow focus on legal guarantees and entitlements to an approach that changes the way in which public policy and law views human rights. It shifts the focus of rights discussions away from legal instruments to the effectiveness of laws, how they actually improve individuals' capabilities. So I found her approach very useful and very interesting, particularly in the context of the list. And in my work with Aboriginal women and communities, this list has provided a very rich exercise in determining what the threshold it is that ordinary Aboriginal women feel that they need to live a fully human, fully dignified life. And I'll just read some of the aspects of her list. She describes life, being able to live to the end of a human life of normal length. Bodily health and integrity, being able to move freely from place to place, being able to secure against violent assault, including sexual assault, marital rape, and domestic violence. Senses and imagination and thought, being able to use the senses, being able to imagine, to think, to reason, and to do these things in a truly human way. Emotions, being able to have attachments in things and persons outside ourselves, being able to love those who love and care for us. Practical reason, being able to form a conception of the good and to engage in critical reflection about the planning of one's life. Affiliation, being able to live for and in relation to others. Other species, being able to live with concern for and in relation to animals, plants, and the world of nature. Play, being able to laugh, to play, to enjoy recreational activities. And finally, control over one's environment. The political, being able to participate effectively in political choices that govern one's lives. And secondly, being able to hold property, having the right to seek employment on an equal basis with others. So this list, it's frankly universal, it's essentialist, but it's important because what it does is it asks communities to focus on what it is that is common to them, what is common to all human life, rather than the focus being on the differences. The list represents a threshold which the state must meet in order that its citizens live a dignified life, and in communities, it's men and women who can decide what that looks like. And it's a very powerful thing to get communities to look at the list and have that conversation, men and women, about what that might look like. And so in reflecting on the list, I'm reminded of the ATSIC evaluation report, which I referred to before. And in this report, they interviewed something like 2,000 Aboriginal women and Torres Strait Islander women, and they asked them, is ATSIC meeting your needs? And 5% said yes. But what the report is rich with, what the report does reveal, is the really unique and specialised way in which Aboriginal women express their rights. So after eliciting from the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women interviewed that they felt marginalised from ATSIC decision-making and policy design, that they felt marginalised from decision-making on land rights, that at the time they felt excluded from the native title negotiations. And an interesting aspect in that report is that women said that they felt that Mabo was a male thing, that women felt unsupported to pursue political and leadership aspirations. So the report then asked women about human rights. What is it that ATSIC can do to support women? And this is what they said. This is a selection of what they said. They said, coin-operated washing machines in women's centres. They said, recreation activities for the elderly in city gymnasiums. Traditional birthing centres. Sober centres. Banning of drunkenness from all living areas and communities to make them safe places for women and children. Vacation programs for communities so children could experience a holiday atmosphere. Women assisting in the design of community houses. An increase of women's health programs such as pap smears, breast cancer awareness, and pre and postnatal education. Parenting classes. Advice on how to do job interviews and CVs and how to enter the workforce. Market gardening. Adult education. Numeracy and literacy. And the list went on. And this was in the response to a question about human rights. And this is the kind of rich and detailed and textured response you get from women when you present them with a list of capabilities of what they want to do, of what they want to be as an autonomous and dignified human being. It provides a practical language that can be used by Aboriginal women to transpose what those rights mean in practice. And in fact, when you give the list to Aboriginal men and Aboriginal women, you get some of the same answers, but you get a lot of different answers. And this is an important thing to embrace because it just reflects the biological differences between the sexes. It reflects a more fully fleshed idea of what self-determination means to communities in their daily lives. So, in terms of solutions, it may not be the capabilities approach. But what's important is to conceive of a new framework so that we don't view self-determination in a one-dimensional way, so that it's not state-centric, and that it's done in a way that all individuals within Aboriginal communities have the freedom to make choices about their lives. So what I wanted to do tonight is start a conversation about how we can reimagine the right to self-determination. The framework that I have laid out is a framework that is consistent with Indigenous advocacy because the list embodies much of what self-determination is about. For example, control over one's environment, affiliation, and especially being able to form a conception of the good and engage in critical reflection about the planning of one's life. So the benefit of this approach that I've spoken about tonight is that it has the practical value of translating the vernacular of the ordinary daily life, which Aboriginal women can use to capture and name a name to local government, a name to state governments, a name to the federal government, what it is that is happening to them on a daily basis. And this approach can provide a benchmark from which to measure how the state and Aboriginal communities have provided the political and material support for Aboriginal women's capabilities. This process is crucial if human rights are to have any meaning and if people are going to benefit from their recognition. The fundamental point is this: how do we ever know if self-determination has been achieved? On this approach, the goal of self-determination is no longer what is best for the community, but rather it becomes more individualised based on capability and functioning. What is she actually able to be and do? What is my neighbour actually able to be and do? What is my auntie actually able to be and to do? And this is a more inclusive way of viewing self-determination and a more accurate way of addressing disadvantage. But I'll conclude with one caution. So long as routine interpersonal violence continues in the daily life experience of Aboriginal women, they can never reach the threshold of what is required to live a dignified human life. Self-determination can never be achieved if half the population is left behind. Thank you.
I'm sure that you all agree with me that that was a tour de force of rigorous inquiry, strong argument, and good common sense, along with a great compassion for the situation in which Indigenous women in Australia find themselves. And I think we should all be very grateful that we have such an advocate for the rights of Aboriginal women, because this is an extraordinarily difficult and tendentious problem. Megan referred to how difficult it is to raise these issues in the Aboriginal community, say, for instance, to report violence against women. It's even more difficult to report violence against the most vulnerable group in our society, and that's Aboriginal girls. And it raises a series of problems that go to reporting such matters, discussing such matters in public, raise problems that, well, for convenience sake here, we could call problems of self-esteem. So one of the objections to any measure to elevate the situation of Aboriginal women and girls has been objections from men in our own communities who say that we are humiliating them, for instance. Just to draw out the very practical implications of what Megan is saying, and so therefore you have not heard these arguments before because it has not been permissible to put these arguments into the public domain because of not only the way that Aboriginal men feel sometimes, say for instance, as many of them said in the Northern Territory, that they felt that they were all being tarred with the same brush because some men were clearly pedophiles. And of course, that's not the point of reporting a crime against a child, is it? The point of reporting a crime against a child is to prosecute the perpetrator, not all men, but the perpetrator or perpetrators. And Indeed, it is, in fact, the way that the discourse, the long intellectual history, the exclusion of women, the language, the intimidation works to prevent women from discussing these matters that has contributed to the denial of the most fundamental of all human rights, and that is the right to choose. And so I'm very proud that this lecture has been given at our university so that we can begin to speak to one of the most difficult problems in our society and to find solutions. I'm very grateful to Megan for finding an intellectual solution, or at least, you know, raising with us tonight various parts of the intellectual solution to this very difficult problem. And I think I've always agreed with the capability argument. I didn't know about Martha Nussbaum's work, although I should have, until Megan mentioned it to me. I had followed Sen and his followers and his critics. But it is so true that the right to choose, and also having the opportunities in which one may choose this way or that way, are fundamental to the enjoyment of human rights. Human rights are meaningless if that's simply black letter law, say the conventions, or standards and guidelines such as the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. And populations like ours have no means by which to implement those rights, to enjoy those rights, to elaborate those rights, to have them mean something in our communities. And yes, I remember when I was living in Alice Springs, one of the huge breakthroughs for the Aboriginal community was to run a campaign to ensure that every child had a shower every day. And a children's choir wrote a song about this important breakthrough, this important social reform. It was called Shower Blocker. So the only showers that people were provided with were, you know, basically public shower blocks. And so the children sang a wonderful song, Shower Blocker. And there were wonderful advertisements on television showing children having showers and how good it was for their health. And so, you know, the right to water, the right to reticulated water, and actually then, what's the next step? Getting the kid into the shower with some soap, you know. And that is capability on the ground. Buying a bar of soap, putting the kid in the shower. The government can provide the water, but you have to put the kid in the shower. And so, you know, I had a little giggle when I heard you say, you know, what did women want? Coin-operated washing machines. Yes, because, you know, your clothes get so dusty in the desert. There's nowhere to wash your clothes. And, you know, just to be clean, people like to be clean. And, you know, they like all of those human conditions that go to our dignity and our self-esteem. To be able to enjoy fundamental human rights mean that there are some extra steps that have to be taken with the written human rights law. And the other thing I think, really, which I know that you didn't have time to say, Megan, but it's so clear to me, is that, you know, for 25 years, Indigenous advocates, mostly men, although I did go once in 1982 to the United Nations, pursued the Declaration and the rights of self-determination, and failed to pursue any of the issues in relation to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the International Labour Organization ILO 169. And, you know, there are some others, the protocols to the rights of the child. And so, you know, I mean, I think that's a body of evidence of the exclusion of women and children from the human rights agenda. Not once were those issues raised, except when there was a blue on back in the late 80s when they said, we don't like the ILO 169 because it doesn't have self-determination written into it. It had labour rights. Well, they weren't interested in labour rights. And of course, the ILO has gone on to become one of the critical defenders of the rights of Indigenous people in the world because they are so often exploited, and it's Indigenous children who are exploited in making chocolates, in making carpets, in making clothes, in making sneakers. I could go on and on. Harvesting food, making objects that go into the consumer market that require tiny fingers to make them. And so I'm absolutely thrilled to have heard your oration, and I want to ask everybody to show their appreciation for this marvellous work. Thank you.
Colleagues, it's my privilege to offer again a vote of thanks to Professor Davis and Professor Langton for an erudite and challenging and deeply thoughtful and passionate commitment shown in our oration. Now, our oration was named very generously by Auntie Joy when we were talking about the spirit of this occasion. It was named to reflect something very local, this place, this country here, the country of Naam, country of Port Phillip Bay. But in many ways, it also transcends that, and that's partly because of our thinking around providing a place where ideas of global significance can be discussed, ideas which are inspirational, which challenge us, which provoke us, which bring joy, which make us angry, which make us think and think deeply about some of the challenges that confront us, can have a place, and a place in the academy where we might contribute to something beyond us. The University of Melbourne has been going under some journey for a number of years in trying to reconceptualise our approach and our contribution and our valuing of Indigenous peoples. Through this last 12 months, we've been through Murat Barak, undertaking a number of conversations both in faculties, with Aboriginal colleagues, with our academic colleagues, and with people from outside the university about our future plans and development. And I had the opportunity to thank a number of colleagues who have contributed from outside the university just earlier this afternoon, who had contributed their time to thinking about some of the challenges in higher education and some of the ways in which this university can rethink the work we do with Aboriginal students. And it was a privilege to say thank you for that bit of work that they had done. But as an institution, I guess it is our goal to both be a place that celebrates, that challenges, which provides a place in which we, as Indigenous Australians, both from the Wurundjeri through all our peoples across the country, can see ourselves, can see our thinking, and can see our contribution, but also an institution in which we can engage collegially with each other, as with non-Indigenous thinkers who are equally committed to reaching these challenges and the deep commitment, both personally and intellectually, to that journey. And I want to thank you all for your contribution tonight in coming along and celebrating Megan's work. I'm kind of inspired. I was thinking very much of a woman who made an extraordinary contribution, has now passed away, Udjuru Noonuccal, Kath Walker, whom many of the Murrays in the room will remember, and many of us who were slightly older but can still remember her contribution. She was a fighter for rights and she made an extraordinary mark on this country. She's also a poet, and she penned a poem called A Song of Hope. The Song of Hope was written partly because she was said she was sick of going to hear toasts to the Queen, and she wanted something that could celebrate Indigenous Australia. And with a slight change of words to reflect the spirit of the night, she ended this poem: to our mothers' mothers, the pain, the sorrow, to their children's children, the glad tomorrow. Thank you.
So it only remains for me to thank you all for coming, for really what's been a terrific evening. Thank you very much for that really challenging address. We actually had a Marchesin on campus last week, not in person, but he was on a video participating in a conference that the Australia India Institute had. And one of the most interesting little sessions in that 2 days of intense argument by the Indians and others was a discussion about some of the tribal groups in some of the more difficult parts of India. And I was thinking, a couple of things. One was I have an idea for that conference next year, I must say, after that discussion. But I was also thinking that the role of this oration, which is to profile leading Indigenous thinkers from across the globe to enrich our vision for the future of Indigenous Australia, really the framework you've offered us is useful not just, I think, for thinking about the future of Indigenous Australia, but really all Australia. And not just Indigenous Australia, but indeed Indigenous people in lots of places. So for lots of reasons, it was a really thought-provoking and really great talk. So thank you very much. That's the end of the proceedings, and I'd ask you all to stand while we process out of here. Thank you very much.